Phil Agnew, welcome to My Worst Leadership Moment podcast. How are you, buddy?
I'm very good, and I'm very excited to be here. I love sharing my failures, so this will be great fun.
Well, a little birdie told me, I think her name was Haley, said apparently you've got a lot of failures.
So Haley said. Oh, brilliant. Great. I've already been dobbed in.
League, mate. Haley would never do that to you. She's such a nice person. I didn't even reach out and ask her.
She would have given you a fair few, actually. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
She may have, mate. Look, I'm gonna leave that honor for you. You can choose your best one, mate. But look, before we dive in the topic of my worst leadership moment, how about you give our listeners and watchers a little bit of background on you, what you're doing, what you're up to in the future. You've got some exciting times ahead from what you've told me.
Yeah, so I'm a marketer. I've spent the last pretty much 10 years in marketing, and I have a real interest in behavioral science and psychology. So understanding why people make the decisions they do. I love figuring out what makes somebody make a decision and how a subtle tweak, a subtle nudge to what you do, to how you maybe ask somebody something will change their decision making. So I specialize in that, read a lot of books on that subject, interview a lot of authors about those, and put all those on my podcast, Nudge, which is the UK's number one marketing podcast, where we cover everything around how you can apply psychology to marketing and business. Exciting news you referred to is that I've been in-house at marketing companies for the past pretty much 10 years, and I'm now going solo, just doing the podcast full-time in the new year, which will be really exciting and probably many more chances to make more mistakes as well. So you'll have to have me back on the show in 12 months, probably.
Mate, we look forward to that. You can share some more, but sincerely fantastic and congratulations on what you've done there, because you know, I know, and those doing a podcast, you know, it's a tough game. It's a hard game to do. I think if anybody gets into it just for that sole purpose of making money, they're kidding themselves. But for you to do what you're doing and to turn that into a full-time gig, mate, all credit to you. Well done.
Thank you.
Mate, let's dive into the juicy part. This is what we're about in this podcast, My Worst Leadership Moment. So how about you share your story of what you consider to be your worst leadership moment?
Yeah, so mine's an interesting one. So I studied marketing, which is a bit weird for a marketer, because most people don't study marketing. There's millions of marketers out there. Very few people actually study it. And I think that's a good thing, because studying marketing is largely useless. you learn all these big strategic things about the four P's and SWOT analysis and, you know, even bits of accounting, all these big business stuff. And you actually don't learn anything that makes you any good at your job. You don't learn about copywriting. You don't learn about persuasion techniques. You don't learn about design elements. You don't learn about psychology. You know, all these things that actually would make you a good marketer. And so I started marketing.
Sorry to interrupt. It sounds like degrees in general, to be honest. I'm not sure they're in that real world, are they?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Sorry to all the academics out there.
Yeah, I know. And I love academics. And I did have a great time at uni as well. But I just found myself, basically, Brendan, I got this job as a marketer at Brownwatch, this Brighton-based tech company that did social media listening. And I was given all these marketing roles very early on into my job, and I just couldn't do them. I couldn't write an email which got people to click. I couldn't write a blog which got people to keep reading. I couldn't do all the things. I wasn't very efficient, despite spending 50 grand on a marketing degree and 4 years of my time. I really wasn't very good at the job. But anyway, I did slowly progress up this organization. I got into product marketing, which is pretty much where I've been for the last 10 years. And in product marketing, a big part of the role there, because we had a really big sales team, was to do these sales enablement sessions and to lead the sales team and teach the sales team about how to sell our product and how to sell our new features. Now, it's a really quite interesting task, because at that point in my life, I was about 24, 25 years old, a graduate out of uni, who, like I said, really had no idea what I was doing. And I was tasked with training a bunch of veteran sales guys. Some of them were making more than the CEO. You know, these are real, the high flyers in the organization. Unbelievably cocky, as you can imagine. Unbelievably arrogant, because that's what sales folks can sometimes be like. And I had to train them and teach them. And that was my task as a 24, 25-year-old with spots on my skin. And what was really interesting is our CMO, who was a veteran CMO, brilliant guy, he had helped us come up with this really good sales enablement framework. So we knew that the content that we had was really, really powerful. We knew that the things we were presenting were really, really good. And yet I would present these to these sales teams and it would just fall flat. It would just never be actioned on. All of the things I would encourage people to do, they would never do. And reflecting back on that, it was quite a major leadership mistake. You know, I was trying to teach a bunch of veterans things that they did need to know, but Jesus, they weren't going to listen to me. And I tried so many different tactics. I tried to make my presentations more engaging. I tried to ask more questions. I used all these smart things you're meant to do to engage people. And they would just look at me and think, who's this kid? Who's this kid? And I realized, I mean, I was in this job for about 5 years, and it wasn't until I got to the end of that tenure when I started to get effective at that. But what was really interesting there is the content never really changed. I was always presenting the same sort of content. What changed, this is something I've since learned, and I think it's a really, really important leadership lesson. What changed is the amount of sunk costs I had put into my job, the amount of effort that I put in, the traction and the track history that I had changed people's perception of me. And it made me realize, and I've since seen this in the world of psychology, that the more effort or the more engagement or the more devotion you've had in a single job, the more likely people are to respect you. There's all sorts of studies that back this up. There's one which I read about recently, which I think just showcases this brilliantly. It's a study with Hindu devotees who are, it's a really interesting study from 2013. I actually don't know exactly what they're doing, but basically these Hindu devotees are asking for people for donations. And by doing it, they are sort of experiencing some sort of pain. They're walking on hot coals or they're putting themselves through pain. And the researchers, God knows how they managed to measure this, but they did. They managed to measure how the levels of ordeal that the devotees would go through. So, you know, how long they would stand on these hot coals, for example, with the amount of donations that they would get. And these were separate populations, so different people analyzing different things, so different devotees. And they found very conclusively that those who experienced a sort of average level of pain, maybe went on the coals for a few seconds, they would get around 81 rupees. But the observers of the high ordeal devotees, the ones who really experienced a lot more pain, received, you know, almost double, 161 rupees on average. And it's, I mean, it's a crazy study and I don't think it should be repeated, but it really shows when people see that you have gone through, you have a lot of experience. So not just that you have experience, when people see that you have a lot of experience and they see that you've gone through a high ordeal, they see your track history, they will engage with you far higher. And that was my problem. I think I would never, the leadership mistake there is a 24-year-old should never have been given those sales enablements, should never have been given those presentations, because I just didn't look like someone with the track history who could convince people. And yet when I was 28 doing the exact same job, giving the exact same presentations, I was far more effective. And I think this is something all leaders should learn. If you're new to a job, don't spend your first month lecturing people. Spend your first month learning every part of the organization, getting in the front lines and seeing how things work, going on sales calls, meeting everybody, experiencing what it's like to be a customer. Because by doing that, not only will you learn a bunch of things which are fantastic, but you will tell your staff, you will show those that ordeal in the same way that those Hindu devotees did. And that will make people value what you suggest more.
In the story you've just said, so much of it resonates with me because I was a similar age, 24, and I got an opportunity I was asked to run workshops as part of a project team in a centralization project for Australia. The glaring variance for me was that where it worked well for me and my experience and my journey was that I ran workshops and very new to the whole process, but I was seeking information from others, from experienced people like the people you're talking about, whereas your situation, and it's certainly a leadership failure in my view that somebody has put you into that situation, that it was you as a young upstart, let's say, trying to teach these senior members on how they should do things.
Yeah, and I think also there was leadership failure on my part as well, because I was trying to lead these individuals. But I didn't really know. I didn't know this idea about how, you know, my lack of history would affect how people perceive this content. I assumed they would love the content because it was written by a leader himself. But I've since realized that the way you present your message can actually change how it's perceived. So if you watch any Steve Jobs keynote when he is introducing a new product, he almost always starts the keynote by saying how much time and how much effort Apple have put into creating this latest feature. They say, oh, We spent 3 years on this. You would, if you'd come around here on the weekends, you would have seen the car parks are full of office workers. We've been working weekends, we've been working nights. And he does this repeatedly every time. And you realize this isn't just something he's saying off the cuff. He's saying it on purpose because he knows that by sharing the effort that they've put into creating this product, that people will value the product more. And I could have done that. Reflecting back, I could have, as a 24-year-old, I could have probably taken the leaf out of your book, Brendan, which is I should have started those presentations by saying, I have spent the past few weeks shadowing some of you experts. So sort of seeking that expert advice. Here's some of the best things that I've learned from you and presenting it back to them. You know, this is how I think this would really resonate with our audience. And I've since tested this. I've run, because this principle vaguely is called the labor illusion. It means when you show the labor behind your work, people value that work higher. And there's all sorts of ways you can describe this, but vaguely it's called that. And I decided to test this for my podcast because, you know, you like me, Brendan, we want people to listen to our shows. So we do all we can to market it. And one of the things I've tried with marketing is creating Reddit ads, which encourage people to click on the ad, go and listen to the show. Very simple. Now, I tested the labor illusion because in my ads, I would test different copy. So half of the participants saw sort of, or half the viewers on Reddit saw simple copy, which said, come and listen to Nudge. Listen to the 6 best marketing tips I've heard this year on Nudge. That was the first one. And then I created a labor illusion variant, which was basically saying the same thing. It just said at the start, I've spent 480 minutes this year listening to marketing experts. Here are their 6 best tips. So the real content is the same. I'm still going to share 6 tips. But the second variant, I'm showcasing the work that I put in. I'm saying I've spent 480 minutes. And the click rate on that second ad was 45% higher than the original. 45% just with one little extra line of copy saying I've invested all this time in listening to these experts. And I now know that I could have done what Steve Jobs did. I could have done the same thing and started those presentations as a sort of young graduate by saying, you know, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I've spent the last 2 weeks shadowing you folks. Here's the best things I've learned about selling this new product. Let's share your best tips. And framing it as that, I think it would have gone down much better.
In the hybrid working world, I've seen too many business owners and their businesses suffer because of poor performing employees, leading to below average results. If you want to improve your employees' performance to deliver consistent results for your business, you have to master one-on-one meetings. The doors to our Master One-on-One Meetings training program are opening soon. I'll teach you how to improve employee performance and deliver consistent results using one-on-one meetings. To be one of the first people notified when the doors open, go to leaderbydesign.au/waitlist. Don't wait. Sign up now. So you're talking a bit to the, obviously, the learning experience, but was that learning well after the fact? And if so, what did you learn sort of in that moment or very soon after that moment that sort of shaped you in a certain way with your leadership?
I think reflecting now, I've learned the value of showcasing the work I've done. I think maybe when I was that age, I had this, because I was viewing other leaders who just went out and presented confidently. I assumed if I did the same thing, I would get the same results, but that wasn't true. I was perceived differently. So I really needed to showcase the effort I had done. And I think that's something I've really invested in when I do similar things or lead, you know, as a manager in future roles or as a leader of future teams. I've always tried to make sure that the team members that I'm managing or coordinating with understand that when we're talking about things, I've invested effort in understanding the problems that they're experiencing, or I've been through the same issues that they've had. I think it's really helpful when you're a leader who has done the same job as the people you're leading, because you can showcase that you've gone through the same thing. You have the same effort. But just simply, I mean, one of the simplest tactics I've taken away is this idea of just making it clear to people that you have invested time into something. There's one, and I know, Brendan, you probably get bored of me for just citing studies, but I do think they are really useful at helping us understand the nuance of human behavior. And there's
get bored, mate. It's actually jogging some memories with your newsletter and some of the episodes that I listen to. So absolutely, shoot away, buddy.
Thank you. Well, there's one from 2003. I read it in Richard Shotton's book, The Illusion of Choice, which is fantastic. And it's a study where they actually analyzed two presenters giving presentations to different audiences. So really similar to the issue that I was coming up against. And the presentations were dead boring. They were presentations about optical switches and electronic ink. You know, people think that people wouldn't find interesting at all. Anyway, they would give these presentations and then they would ask the audience at the end, how highly did they value the presentation? All sorts of questions, actually. What do you think of the presenter? How interesting was the content? How much do you remember doing recall tests? But they would flip. They would do these presentations multiple times and there would be a bit of an A-B test. And sometimes they would say, this presentation, say the electronic ink presentation, it took 8 hours and 34 minutes to create. So they state that right at the start, just to let you know, we spent 8 hours, 34 minutes creating this. And other times they would say, this presentation on electronic ink just took 37 minutes to create. And they would flip it for both ones. And they found when they said the presentation took 8 hours, 37 minutes to create, no matter which presentation it was, they would always say that presentation was more valuable, that the speaker was more engaging, that the content was more memorable, regardless of whether it was about electronic ink or optical switches. Just stating that it took longer to create that presentation made people value it more highly. And it sounds almost like, wow, that's magic. How do they do that? But then you realize, well, this is just a core tenet of life. If you know an artist has spent 10 years working on a sculpture and you hear the story of how they've toiled away on that sculpture for 10 years of their life, God, you're going to look at that thing. That's incredible. But if you hear that the exact same sculpture was created in 2 minutes by a 3D printer, you're not even going to look at it for a second glance. And there's a real leadership point which we can take away from this, which is leaders who have skin in the game, leaders who have invested time, leaders who show that they invest time will be more effective. As a great example from Julius Caesar, actually, he if you read his biography, one of his things that he always had is he was always adored by the armies that he ran, and that was quite different from a lot of the other leaders, Pompey, for example. And I mean, it's difficult to figure out why, but there are a few reasons. One is Caesar would always sleep with his men in the trenches. He would always he would never choose to sleep away or experience better quality living standards, despite a lot of his illnesses as well. And his men really valued him for that. He would call them comrades rather than calling them, you know, a more hierarchical name, so it would really be on the same level. And famously, when he was fighting Pompey, they had this awful moment where they were close to rebellion because they had nothing to eat. And all they could eat was this awful bread, which was, I think, you know, pretty disgusting. But Caesar made sure that he ate that exact bread in the company of all of his men, and made sure that his men knew that he was eating that bread. So he was basically showcasing he's going through the same thing as them, and that apparently kept morale together. Churchill used to do the same thing as well. He would always insist on visiting the trenches. He actually wanted to be at the D-Day landing. There's an amazing story about how Churchill really wanted to be at D-Day, and he only didn't go because he was. The king pleaded with him not to go. It's like, you can't go to D-Day. You can't be on the beach. You are the commander. You're the prime minister. You can't be there. But he had such skin in the game. He always wanted to be on the front line. He wanted his troops to know he was as engaged as them. And I think that's a fascinating leadership tactic, which you see amongst Steve Jobs, Winston Churchill, Julius Caesar, and then, you know, even just playing out the most simple studies, showcasing that you've put effort, labor, skin in the game into something will make the people who are perceiving you value you more as a leader. And I think that's a really crucial point.
Yeah, absolutely. And straight away, I think about just what you shared earlier in the show, and even when we were talking pre-recording, is you're putting skin into the game. You've had your podcast Nudge, and it's been fantastic. And again, as I said, I listened to it religiously, and great episodes. But you are putting skin in that game. Right, you're going all in, you're going full time on that. So it'll be interesting to see that as you announce that to the world, how that resonates in your sort of continued increase in downloads and those sorts of things. Sort of knowing you, you're probably running a test on that sort of thing, are you?
Well, I mean, Brendan, you're bang on, aren't you? Like, it is guaranteed that if I created an episode which was called something like, you know, a life-changing decision for me, or the biggest decision I've made in my life, you know, really like bigging it up, and I'm going full time on Nudge, I'm putting all these hours in. That would be very engaging. That would probably be my best episode, because it's doing that same thing. People like it when people commit to things. This is why hunger strikes work. Hunger strikes don't work because they shock and grab attention. No, they work. There are lots of things that can shock and grab attention. You know, lots and lots of things. The reason hunger strikes really work is because they show skin in the game. If a hunger strike continues, the person will die. And I think that level of commitment, showcasing that level of ordeal, just like those devotee Hindus that we spoke about at the start, will make people value them more. You know, you and I could probably grow a podcast a bit faster if we said we're not going to eat until our podcasts are number one in the charts. People would probably end up just listening to be like, God, these two are committed. We're getting a bit away from leadership strategies here, but this is one of the ways that Mr. Beast is sort of the world's largest media person at the moment. He's this YouTuber who gets hundreds of millions of views. He's got more subscribers than the population of Russia, the biggest YouTuber in the world. And there's a lot of reasons behind his success, but one of the core reasons is that he always has a bit of skin in the game. He makes, I think, 51 million a year. He reinvests, I think it's 49 million of those. And most of that is in these incredible prizes that he gives his contestants when they play his game. So he recreated Squid Games, and I think gave the winner $500,000, but also gave much, much more away to other people in that video. So, you know, people are watching these videos and saying, oh my God, this kid basically is spending so much money on creating this incredible video and creating this incredible show. Because he is spending so much, I must value this content more because he's so clearly invested. And I think that helps him get virality and viral because he can showcase his investment so well. Whereas, you know, the sensible thing to do if you make 51 million would be to at least, you know, take a profit margin of 50% and just put it in the bank. But Mr. Beast knows that it's an algorithm game. If he can keep investing more than everybody else, he will seem more committed than everybody else. And if he seems more committed, people will value his videos more, be more likely to watch him. So it's a really, psychologists will listen to this.
It's fascinating.
You're butchering a lot of principles. You're combining a lot together. But this idea around skin in the game, labor illusion, input bias, showcasing your effort, it does make a leader, at least will be perceived by others as you know, a better leader, I believe.
Absolutely. And, you know, the credibility that comes with that. So how, in all of this said, and, you know, some great studies cited, as I expected you to do, it wouldn't be Phil Agnew if you didn't do that, mate. So how has that experience, that knowledge, and that ongoing learning you've developed over time shaped your own leadership journey and what you do today around having skin in the game and those sorts of things?
I think the one takeaway for me, and this is something Rory Sutherland says a lot, is that this exact same message that a leadership shares can be perceived very differently based on how that message is shared. So let's use an example. Lots of leaders at the moment are trying to bring staff back to the office. They've got big costs on their office and they need to bring staff back to the office. So lots of leaders are struggling with this. Now, how do you bring staff back to the office? You could, for example, say to staff, you have to come in 2 days a week and frame it that way. Or you could reframe it in a completely different way and say, we've spoken a lot about it and we're very happy to announce that you will be able to work from home 3 days a week ongoing into the future. So just the way you frame it can make that message more appealing. Not the most engaging example, but you can see how these sort of things play out. Just changing the way you share your message as a leader will change how it's perceived. I'm going to cite another study, Brendan, but there's one I found recently, which I put in my newsletter, which is very relevant to leaders because it was looking at how academics or I think it was professors gave feedback to their students in their coursework. And what the professor did is just slightly changed the way they gave their feedback to students. So for half of the students, they said, I'm giving you these comments on your coursework or your work because I have to, which is just very truthful. They do have to. They're paid to do it. I'm just going to give you these comments because I have to, and then they would go on and give all their feedback. In the other half, the professor similar batch of students, different population, but similar batch. So these, you know, there's a big enough number of students that these two are comparable. But this time the professor would say to everybody, I'm giving you this feedback because I have high expectations of you. So what's that doing? That is lifting the self-perception of the reader. It's engaging them. And it's also making them think, oh, this professor has a high expectation of me. I should live up to that expectation. And then the professor would go on to give the exact same feedback that they were giving anyway. But then the professor would monitor how all these things about these two groups. So what was the attendance level of the high expectation group versus the control group? What was the actual grades of both? How promptly did they give in their coursework, stuff like that? And across every metric, the group who was simply told that I have high expectations of you engaged more. They were more effective. They got higher grades, they gave their coursework back earlier, and they gave their coursework back on time as well. So it's a really simple way, and I think this is something that leaders really need to pay attention to. You can create a policy, for example, like we're going to give more feedback to our staff. And that policy you might think is just black and white. We either do it or you don't. But the way you get feedback alone can dramatically change how people engage. So my push, for me, this is how it shaped me as a leader, is to really think about the psychology behind the messages I'm sharing. How am I sharing my message and how will it be perceived? And is there a way I can share it in a slightly different way that will make that message be perceived in a better manner? How can I find the high expectation variant for my message to the people I'm leading, because that will engage them more?
I love it, mate. There's a couple of things, and that are sort of effective messaging and the psychology, some of the research attached to that can be really helpful from a leadership perspective. Absolutely. I think the intent is always important again. And I always say, well, as from a leadership perspective, you should always be coming from that right intent. So that's an important thing. And the other thing that sticks out is that getting back to hunger strikes, I really hope that people would listen more. I would be very worried if they allowed us to die from hunger, because that just means they want to take us off the airwaves completely, mate. So that would be very concerning for both of us, I think. Mate, I really appreciate you coming on again. We sought you out, and you're a fantastic guest on Culture of Leadership podcast. I think it was episode 83 or something like that. So a little while back, again, that what you've shared today and the knowledge and backing it with the research, the studies, the science, always super important. So I appreciate that, mate. Fantastic to get your insights on your worst leadership moment. And thanks for being so vulnerable and sharing it with our listeners and our watchers today. Thanks for being a guest on My Worst Leadership Moment.
Thanks so much, Brendan. Thanks for creating a wonderful podcast. And thanks so much for having me on.
Pleasure, buddy.